Thus we have a contrast between Roman and Israeli images, telling us a tale of two societies and a battle between two worldviews. One, the Roman, which celebrated violence and death, and the other, the Jewish, which celebrates life and love. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 99, Judea Capta. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. What museum contained in its collection the most extraordinary objects in the history of the world? If you could visit any exhibit in any edifice throughout the ages, what would it be? To me, the answer is obvious, and it is not the Louvre or the Hermitage or any palace of yesteryear or even the ancient library at Alexandria. No, ladies and gentlemen, the answer is and must be an edifice that was designed in and erected in the 70s CE, immediately after the destruction of Jerusalem. This building was created by the Emperor Vespasian in order to exhibit the manifold treasures taken from his one major conquest, the Temple in Jerusalem. The building and the golden objects within it made it one of the wonders of the world, and the name that Vespasian bestowed upon it was the Temple of Peace. So that, for the decades following the fall of Jerusalem, if you wish to see the menorah, or the table of the showbread, or the altar of incense, you can make your way to the Roman Forum and visit the Temple of Peace. It is clear that the rabbis visited there, for they make references to seeing objects of the temple. And if they refused to give the edifice its appellation, if they said only, when I was in Rome, rather than when I visited the Temple of Peace, it is surely because the rabbis realized the profound and painful untruth that this appellation announced to the world. This building was a temple of peace, where everyone could come see what Rome took from a country that it had brutally destroyed. This, in turn, allows us to contrast Jewish and Roman culture at the time of the Second Temple's destruction. Historian Martin Goodman notes that Jews, like Romans, recognize the reality of war and its necessity, but at the same time, he writes, Jews have been careful never to idealize warfare, to glorify warfare as an end in itself. Quote, Jews, as much as Romans, viewed war as a natural condition, but unlike Romans, they sometimes expressed a hope that this might change, end quote. Despite the place of war in the Hebrew Bible, at the same time, Goodman notes, quote, the biblical prophets Isaiah, Micah, and Joel all looked forward with longing to a time when there would be no more war at all. And he adds, this notion of peace, shalom, and an end to war espoused by Isaiah was quite different from the Roman notion of pax, which constituted little more than a pause to take stock between victorious and glorious campaigns, end quote. That is why Rome saw nothing strange in celebrating their brutal conquest in a temple of peace. For them, war was the object. War was inevitable. The temple to Pax would allow them to celebrate their victories and rest so that more victories could follow. For Jews, the opposite is true. War is important at times, essential, but never an end in itself. And to my knowledge, the most eloquent expression of this Jewish worldview in modern times was Menachem Begin's 1978 speech in Oslo after he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. It was Jews, Begin noted, who gave the very notion of true peace to the world. He said, quote, two prophets, Yeshayahu ben Amoz and Micha HaMorashti, having foreseen the spiritual unity of man under God, with his word coming forth from Jerusalem, gave the nations of the world the following vision expressed in identical terms, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Begin, of course, understood that those assembled in the auditorium did not necessarily see him as a man of peace, but as a fighter. He therefore reminded them implicitly of the fact that his own father and mother had been murdered, that the world had done nothing to stop it, and that this had taught him that evil often had to be fought before peace was possible. Begin added, but in my generation, ladies and gentlemen, there was a time indescribable. 6 million Jews, men, women, and children, a number larger than many a nation in Europe, were dragged to a wanton death and slaughtered methodically in the heart of the civilized continent. And he further said, other than a few famous and unforgettable exceptions, they were left alone to face the destroyer. At such a time, unheard of since the first generation, the hour struck to rise and fight for the dignity of man, for survival, for liberty, for every value of the human image a man has been endowed with by his creator, for every known inalienable right he stands for and lives for. Indeed, There are days when to fight for a cause so absolutely just is the highest human command. Norway has known such days, and so have we. Only in honoring that command comes the regeneration of the concept of peace. Let it, however, be declared and known, stressed and noted, that fighters for freedom hate war." End quote. For Jews, in other words, war is at times necessary, but never something beloved. Peace is the aspiration. This is what separates Judaism from Rome, and we, in turn, can find that contrast in a Roman relic of the age of the destruction, one which highlights all for which Rome stood and why it is such a wonder to ponder the Jewish people's endurance today. As we have seen, much of Vespasian's resume and that of his family was built on the destruction of Judea and Jerusalem. Therefore, the Rome of this period was marked by the creation of enormous advertisements of the Roman victory. There was the Arch of Titus, another arch proclaiming the destruction of Jerusalem that was built in the Circus Maximus. There was the Colosseum, created right after the fall of Jerusalem, which we shall discuss tomorrow. And then there was the actual Roman currency, for Vespasian had minted Roman coins proclaiming his conquests throughout the empire. We have sent you an image of one such coin. The coin famously features on one of its sides the sneering face of Vespasian, on the other a palm tree under which stands a Jewish soldier stripped of his weapons, his hands bound behind his back, and a Jewish woman in mourning. These captives are a source of Roman gloating, and it highlights for me how Rome made conquest and victory in war an end in itself and a source of celebration. Pondering this, we realize that there is an even more painful irony to the fact that the treasures of Jerusalem were placed in an edifice in Rome called the Temple of Peace, because the Jewish view of war and peace, as articulated by Begin, was actually best embodied by the Jewish temple. This sacred building, as we have seen, was the dream of David, the summit of its hopes. But this desire was denied by God because, as David himself says in Chronicles, he was a man of war. But this does not mean that we do not celebrate David's military heroism. Rather, as we noted, David was special precisely because he gave glory for his victories not to himself but to God. And therefore, had David concluded his career by building what would have inevitably been seen as a monument to his might, had Israel's greatest warrior built a temple, the Israelites would have been tempted to see David's lifetime endeavors of war as achievements to glorify on par with their worship of the divine. Thus, David's dream was denied lest Judea become Rome. The temple would be built not by David in Jerusalem, but rather by his son Solomon. We are therefore able to understand that the temple of which David dreamed, the temple whose design he gave to Solomon, was a temple of peace, and that it is therefore so profoundly painful to consider how a society that celebrated war, Rome, marked the destruction of the Jewish temple by creating a quote-unquote temple of peace of its own. But as with most of these Roman exaltations, there is an inspiring element to be found by Jews, and that is true of the Judaea Capta coin. In various versions of the coin, one image frequently appears, the palm tree. This is because the Judean date palm was once a symbol of Jewish society in the Holy Land, a land known for the quality of its dates and for the palms that flourished there. Like so much else of Second Temple Judea, the palms eventually were lost in the years following the destruction, and this species of tree and fruit ultimately went extinct. But, as we've noted in other Tikva lectures, some decades ago, the excavators of Masada discovered a storage of date seeds from fruit that had been stockpiled by the besieged defenders of the fortress. Those seeds lay dormant in a drawer until they were taken by a scientist, Elaine Salove, who succeeded in resurrecting from almost 2,000-year-old seeds the Judean date palm. The first tree was known as Methuselah because of its age, planted in the soil of the Negev, and some years later, Salove resurrected other Judean date palms and succeeded in producing dates of the original Judean variety, thus giving us an incredible, striking symbol of the resurrection and resilience of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. And there is another date palm-related symbol of Jewish resurrection, which speaks to the Jewish worldview itself. In 1958, long before this botanical wonder occurred, Israel minted a response to Vespasian's Judea Capta coin. This coin, which we have also sent you, features free Jews, a man engaged in planting, and a woman playing with her child under a palm tree. Over the picture, the words appear, Israel Liberata. Thus we have a contrast between Roman and Israeli images, telling us a tale of two societies and a battle between two worldviews. One, the Roman, which celebrated violence and death, and the other, the Jewish, which celebrates life and love. One the Roman, which gloried in conquest and destruction. The other the Jewish, which celebrated planting and building. One the Roman, which celebrated the killing of people. The other the Jewish, which celebrates the giving of birth and the bringing of new life into the world. In 2015, it was reported by the media that Rome, marking a city anniversary, had decided to quote-unquote restore the Temple of Peace. Reading these articles, I was interested. What does that mean? How could one restore Vespasian's Museum of Temple Treasures? But upon closer study, I learned that all Rome was doing was bringing back several columns of the structure that used to exist. Otherwise, the temple would look as it is, a ruin. What had been built to celebrate Rome's power and conquest is now a testament to its own destruction. There may be no better embodiment of the Jewish people's endurance versus that of Rome than the fact that Rome's Temple of Peace is now in pieces. Or perhaps one greater reflection of Jewish eternity is the story of a man named Menachem, who experienced so much destruction in the life of his family and his people. Standing as prime minister of a Jewish state before an international audience in Oslo, proudly speaking both of Jewish suffering and of the prophetic vision and all that it gave to the world. We conclude with his words, which he said at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Quote, "Allow me now to turn to you, Madam President of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, and to all its members and say thank you. I thank you for the great distinction. It does not, however, belong to me. It belongs to my people, the ancient people and the Renaissance nation that came back in love and devotion to the land of its ancestors after centuries of homelessness and persecution. This prestigious recognition is due to this people because they suffered so much, because they lost so many, because they love peace and want it with all their hearts." This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together next week. Wishing you a Shabbat Shalom. Signing off.